The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Welcome to Strange Familiars. If you've seen something strange, a cryptid like Bigfoot, a ghost, a UFO, anything paranormal, and you'd like to share your story on the show, or if you know of a story you think we should cover, you can email us, strangefamiliarspodcast@gmail.com. Hello, Allison.
Hi, Tim.
We've entered the hot stage of the summer.
Yeah.
This is my least favorite time of the year, because it's the time I feel least like hiking.
Yeah.
I sweat from now until the end of August.
Well, we have so many other options of things to do right now.
Yeah, right. So, June was basically Bigfoot month on Strange Familiars.
It did appear that way.
Every show was about Bigfoot, and we didn't even get the Where the Footprints End interviewing yet.
Which means there will be more Bigfoot.
There will be more Bigfoot. I actually have more Bigfoot banked, and I was trying to do something non-Bigfoot tonight.
And then Bigfoot arrived.
He always does. I can't seem to keep him away. We're talking with Al tonight, who has several stories of different strange encounters he had around British Columbia. But because it's British Columbia, we inevitably descend into Bigfoot talk anyway. So try as I might, can't keep away from the big guy. I'm glad everybody enjoyed the Through the Haunted Forest shows. We have more coming up. It's going to be multi-parts, but all the parts aren't going to drop in a row. Let's go ahead and get to Al's stories. Tonight we are talking with Al, who has contacted me with several experiences from the British Columbia area, and it's kind of throughout your life, isn't it?
Yeah, and it really stems from this one highway that I grew up on, Highway 26, on the way to Barkerville, which is a historic town now. It was back in the 1860s. It was a hub of a lot of activity with the gold rush. So where my family came into it, like, my dad's family came up from Virginia, and my great-grandparents and grandparents had two adjoining properties, 5 acres each parcel, and they settled there in the early 50s. Right across their yard was where the old wagon trail was.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so they found tons of old bottles and horseshoes and mule shoes and things like that. It was a watering hole for, like, when they would it was in those days it was known as the James Douglas Highway.
Okay.
Named after the governor of the Dominion of British Columbia at the time. And so to go back to when my dad was a kid and my uncle, they shared a bedroom. And in this room, and it was in my grandparents' house. Now, for whatever reason, this one room seemed to be the center of some really abnormal paranormal activity for my uncle and my dad growing up. Lots of night terrors, lots of sleep paralysis, seeing or feeling somebody in the room with them. And it would get so bad, like they, especially like I'm, you know, my uncle, he was younger. He didn't like to even sleep in the room by himself. Hmm. And for my uncle, these dreams, like he used that room until he was 20, you know, just very strange dreams they would have. Like my grandparents had a Rottweiler that he got for them named Dago. And one morning, my uncle's sleeping, like he's sleeping in, and he has this dream that Dago is at his bed and has human hands and is strangling him.
Oh, wow.
So he wakes up out of this, and the dog is sitting right there. Yeah. And then, of course, next door was where my great-grandparents lived, and I ended up living in their house after they passed, and that's where I had some other paranormal activity to kind of keep the timeline in sync. We lived on the property until I was 4 in a house in the back of my great-grandparents' property. And I remember myself having a very strange, I believe it was a dream. I wasn't too sure. I was about 4. And I remember it very vividly that there was, I don't know if you've ever seen them, but the styrofoam heads that a wig would be on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Just a bust.
Mm-hmm.
So that was in my window. And it was 2 stories up. Like, it was, there was a big garage. Like, it was up about a floor and a half. So I remember distinctly, you know, it was first thing in the morning and freaking out, you know, and telling my mom. And my mom thought it was something I'd watched on TV. And I remember distinctly going outside and looking around the corner, you know, just to see for myself. So not too long after that, my parents bought a house. So this property area is up on top of a place known as Mouse Mountain. So we moved a little further closer to town. It wasn't right in town, but it was at the bottom of the mountain. And it was a little 2-bedroom house. Very plain, no bathroom, had an outhouse, and my sister and I shared a room. And at this time, I would have been 5 going on 6, and my sister would have been about 4. And one night, we're in bed, and we're just getting settled, and in our window is the perfect facial silhouette of a witch. No hat or anything, but, you know, like an old crone, right?
Mm-hmm.
The chin, the nose, the scraggled hair. And what's interesting is that there's no trees back behind our window. It's an open field because our house, our property was adjacent to a field, farmer's field. And, oh, so we scream and, you know, everything, tell our parents and, you know, what we had seen. And, you know, there was nothing about that house in particular that there was no bad stories, you know, to our knowledge, nothing bad ever happened on the property or anything like that. It was a house built by, you know, kind of a lovely local man who built a lot of houses in the area and, you know, was a good guy. And so there was nothing, you know, that would, you know, no type of story or anything that would, you know, maybe indicate that 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 place could be haunted. So a few years later,
Before we move on from that, when you say a silhouette, so you could, this was outside of your window?
It was outside the window, and it was like a perfect silhouette, not like a shadow or anything like that. It was like a black cutout.
Wow. So did it seem like something was standing there or someone?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, oh, man, you know, I can still see it. I can still feel the panic, mm-hmm. you know?
Was it backlit by something? What made it
stand out? No, like the night was, you know, because we were younger, we had to go to bed a little bit earlier, right?
Right, yeah.
And so at the time of the year, I believe it was late spring. So it would start getting dark about 8:30, 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was definitely twilight, not completely pitch black, but
enough to see the contrast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Between the light of the twilight outside and the contrast of what was in the window.
Now, I know your sister was younger, but does she have a memory of this?
Yes.
Does she? Oh,
but wow. she doesn't talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the case sometimes.
Yeah. And like I said, a few, you know, we weren't the only ones to see it. A few years later, my parents purchased a mobile home, put it on the property, and the house was used as then like a spare house, right? For storage. Guests would come over, they'd sleep in the living room. And my cousins from up north, they were a few years older than us, and they came. There was three of them. So their ages are ranging 11, 12, 13. Mm-hmm. And they got their sleeping bags, and they thought it was cool. Like, they're going to get to sleep in the living room of this house, you know, like their own little guest house. And they were sleeping in the living room, and there was a living room window in which is right in line with the bedroom window where we've seen that witch, right, because the room is just adjacent to it. And the same thing, no foliage, just the back field. Through the living room window, and they had seen the same thing. They seen it outside, you know, kind of similar light conditions, a mm-hmm. Little bit darker, but they had seen the, you know, they said they seen a witch in the window.
Wow.
And that was, yeah, it was probably, I'm thinking, 3-4 years after when we had seen, yeah, it would have had to have been at least 4 or 5 years after we had seen it.
Right. But you were vindicated.
Yeah, like, see? You know, because, you know, sometimes kids see things, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know,
sure.
It's, yeah. You know, you have, kids have imaginations and things like that, right? And, you know, so, you know, even though it was, you know, me and my sister that seen it, you know, it was, and I believe my dad went outside to check things and, you know, there was nothing out there or anything like that. And, mm-hmm. And when my cousins had their experience, they ran across the yard to the mobile where we all were in, and they would not go back in the house. That was it for them.
But they described it the same way, same kind of silhouette.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and to this day, I don't even know what it was. If it was a ghost or what it was, but something that was able to manifest itself to look like a witch,
right.
Like an old crone. Yeah. And like scaring kids, apparently. So
yeah, there you go.
The house is tore down now, and you know, but when I drive by it, I always think about it, you know, drive by the property. It still flashes into my head. Like, what was that?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know if there's atypical haunting, but you know,
yeah, no, but you know, it certainly has these themes kind of pop up along with these things where you get these similar themes again and again.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and I only until recently had I heard about other people seeing witches like that. And for years and years I had heard, you know, it seems so unique, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'm hearing occasionally, you know, on different podcasts and things like that, other people are seeing something very similar, you know, and it's interesting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How something would, you know, typically, you know, a lot of spirits and things like that will move in shadows or in orbs or things like that, or can manifest themselves if they have enough energy to a little bit more of a solid form. But, you know, usually it's fairly ambiguous. It's lots of times hard to tell what, you know, other than a shape like a person.
Right.
But these features were very, very distinct.
As far as the silhouette, the outline.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Of the witch. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that keeps coming up is, you know, when I talk to people, is this blacker than black idea that people say, or, you know, blacker than the night around it kind of thing. And so these, I guess they're shadow figures or whatever they are, but that does seem to keep popping up.
Yeah. And the only time I had seen anything similar to that, I was in my early 20s and I was living back up on Mouse Mountain, and I was living in my grandparents' house, my great grandparents' house, after they had passed. And that was right by where the watering hole was for all the miners and everybody going up to Barkerville, which was at the time in the 1860s, a pretty major city. There had had a population of 10,000 people, which was at the time the largest city west of St. Louis and north of San Francisco.
Wow.
And with that comes this whole huge history, right? They started building the James. It was just basically goat trails going up to the gold fields at the time. And eventually they built a road all the way from Vancouver and Fort Yale all the way up to Barkerville. And all of these communities throughout the province were all mile markers and stops and roadhouses. And those communities still exist today. So basically the infrastructure of our province, you know, was created by this gold rush in the 1860s and the locale of Barkerville. So there's a ton of history all up and down, you know, from Barkerville all the way down to the lower mainland.
It must have been a pretty magical place to grow up and play as a kid.
Oh, you know, going up to the historical part, the town is still a historical town. You know, it burnt down in 1868 and was pretty much fully rebuilt by 1880. And I worked there for a time, actually. My dad, he still works there. And I used to drive team in another location called Cottonwood, which is on the way to Barkerville. And that place, too, is, you know, and working in those places where these old homesteads and Barkerville, too, you're there by yourself very early in the morning, and you feel like you're being watched. Like, huh. it's kind of a never anything malevolent or anything like that, but mm-hmm. just an uneasiness, right? You know, you're there's some energy there, some history for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you get in those certain places where you can just feel the history that's there with you.
Yeah. And some of the history wasn't so good, right? A lot of people came to make their fortune. They died in their 30s. You know, all these people that were poor and immigrants and people coming to strike it rich, and then the despair mm-hmm. of not and dying, you know, dying trying to get there and dying out in the gold field somewhere too, you know. And all sorts of different legends and things like that up and down that Douglas Highway. One, in fact, it was outside the Clinton area where there was this woman who ran a roadhouse by herself. And the story goes, she was a large woman with red hair. All the miners would stop in on the way up and stop in on the way back down to the lower mainland. And unbeknownst, she was a serial killer. When the miners were coming back from the gold fields, if they had the misfortune of stopping there, people believed that she was poisoning the miners, and she would bury them out back and keep their gold. So, you know, just different little things that, you know, there's all the the rich history and everything, but there's a bit of dark history there too, right?
So sure, yeah, yeah. That, usually with gold comes some of that as well.
Yeah, and so back to you know the house, my great grandparents' house. There was one time I was in my bedroom, and right at the door, I was tossing and turning. I wasn't quite asleep, and I kind of felt something, and I roll over in bed, and the door is open, and I can see this silhouette of a man with a prairie cap on. If you know what a prairie cap is, you know, like the newsboy type of hat from that era, the flat hat. And you're standing there, and I'm just like, you know, at first I thought it was somebody in my house, right? And then as I start to get up, he just tips his hat, and as he turns to go away, and as he turns, just vanish.
Wow.
And eventually my son was living with me there, and it was my son and myself, and my parents lived next door behind us, and they would always pop in all the time. And one time my son, he would have been about three, and he was a pretty active talker, and he's sitting at his chair eating dinner, and I was in the next room, and I hear him talking to somebody, and I thought, oh, my dad popped over for a visit, because I can hear him talking away. And I go out there, I say, where's Papa? Who are you talking to? And he's like, that kid over there. And he points to this to the brick stove work. He says, I'm talking to that kid there. And I look, and of course there's nothing there. You know, and I just sort of wonder, okay, sometimes kids have imaginations and things like that. And then fast forward probably about 10 years, my son is staying at my parents' house on the property, and there is an outhouse. One evening, I forget why he had to use the outhouse. He was outside or something, and he goes to use the outhouse there, which is, you know, right by our old house. And while he was in there, something grabbed him. And this happened, it was the late evening when this happened. It was starting to get dark, and so he still is pretty shook up about that. He's 23 now, and just for him, it was just like so major. He doesn't remember being a kid and talking
right
but to anything in the house.
But he remembers this other thing.
Oh yeah, he remembers being grabbed. And yeah, just very unexplained, you know. One other interesting thing happened on that property, and this was not a good story. It still makes me pretty upset. But this is about 20 years ago, and I was still living there, and I went next door to visit my grandpa. And my grandpa, at the time, he wasn't doing too good. He had cancer. And he was telling me that, so to give you a kind of a overview of the property, both properties are fenced off. There's a fence partition between the two properties. And over the years, you know, we've had horses and cows and, you know, all sorts of things out back. So a really well-fenced property. You go back, there's a couple of houses down one road, but, you know, basically bush. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I go over to visit my grandpa, and he says, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do about this dog. And I'm like, what dog? And he says, oh, somebody dropped off a dog here. And I'm like, I would say, well, I didn't see anything. And he goes, yeah, it's out in the back. And I'm like, out in the back? I'm like, how could somebody have, you know, who would have dropped off a dog over a 5-foot fence into the back property? And I thought, okay, I'm going to go take a look. And sure enough, there's this canine. It was the weirdest looking dog I had ever seen. And it was in a bad way. Like, it had light gray eyes, which I assumed, okay, maybe it's got really bad cataracts, you know? But I couldn't put my finger on what kind of a species this dog was. And it looked disfigured. Like I said, it was wandering in a circle, in a small circle. That's all it was doing. Over and over and over again. And I went to it, you know, it could hear me, and, you know, approach it, and it seemed harmless, seemed friendly enough, but like I said, it, you know, sometimes people around here, we get what's called koi dogs.
Yeah, yeah, we have them.
Yeah, and sometimes they can look amazing, sometimes they're very beautiful dogs, and other times they look like the weirdest thing that was ever created. Mm-hmm. Something very unfortunate.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you get that weird mix of coyote, wolf, and dog, and they can look pretty rough.
Yeah. And so this dog, like it was just like nothing I'd ever... And I've seen lots of koi dogs before, and hybrids and stuff like that. I'm a dog lover and, you know, very familiar with pretty much any breed around our parts. And what was troubling was how it was behaving and how it looked. It was just, it was a mess, and you could tell it was suffering greatly. So my grandpa, he was too sick to take care of it. Right. Mm-hmm. And, so I told him, okay, well, I'll take care of it for you. That process didn't go so well. You know, I love animals and I, you know, we were raised, you know, hunting, fishing, all that thing, to really respect nature, respect animals, and to do things in a good way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm about 20, and I figured, you know, I'm in my early 20s, I figured, okay, I need, you know, back then, we just took care of things ourselves, right, out there. Yeah, it took 5 shots to the head.
Oh, wow.
It would not die.
Hmm.
And that, yeah, it still bothers me, right? And how I think about, what was it, and why did it take, you know, another weird thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes, yeah, there's a couple other weird canine type stories. One was heading out to a remote fishing resort, a friend of mine and I, and his wife, and this is way out in the bush, and we're coming along the road, and I see over on the bank what looks like a black German Shepherd. And I'm thinking, you know, my mind's going, oh man, this dog is lost. Somebody must, you know, got out, you know, stopped for a minute, the dog got out, the dog's wandering lost. So being the dog lover, I'm like the first one out of the vehicle to go approach his dog, see if I can coax it and take it to the resort and see if maybe its owners are there.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm approaching it, I notice something peculiar about it. It starts to lower its head like a wolf. And I'm like, come on, boy, you know, right. Calling it, you know, trying to be nice. And as I get closer, I can see it has yellow eyes. And I'm just like, it is a wolf. And around here, you're lucky to see a wolf at 300 yards, right? They know you're there before you even know that you're there, type of thing. And they're gone. In the wild, I've seen maybe 2 wolves, and they're like, you know, hundreds of yards away. And as soon as they see you or sense you, they are gone. So it was very, very peculiar because, you know, I'm within 50 feet of this wolf. And, you know, while it kind of lowered its head, it then just calmly walked off into the tree line.
I mean, as weird and unsettling as that must be, it also has to be incredible to get that close to a wolf.
It was.
Yeah.
It was like, I had a hybrid years ago. And, you know, that's different, right? It's raised in captivity, and it's 75% timber wolf and 25% husky malamute. This was something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and why it behaved like that, I don't know if it was sick or dying or, you know, or what it was, but it was very uncharacteristic behavior for a wolf.
Yeah. Is rabies unusual up there?
No. No. So bats are carriers. Fox are carriers. Mm-hmm. Coyote. It runs, you know. We were always taught as a kid, hey, if you think, you know, a fox is letting you come close to it, it's probably because it's sick and has rabies and it's going to bite you. So don't pet it.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's the behaviors that, you know, like fox, coyote, and other animals, when they get rabies, they get pretty messed up in mm-hmm. their mind, right? They don't react like they normally do. And I had a coyote, same thing, on the highway, stopped and almost thought it was going to get into the truck with me, right? Hmm. Give it a couple pieces of pepperoni, which you're not supposed to do. Do not feed the wild. But, you know, it was just the weirdest thing. The coyote was coming to me. So, but it didn't look sick. It looked pretty healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Another unsettling story of involving a canine. This happened just recently. Me and one of the guys from work, we sometimes travel out of town to work. So the next day, I'm driving back by myself after the work day, and it's dark and it's raining and it's stormy. And here, right on the side of the road, walking down the road in the middle of nowhere, is a pig. Not a wild boar or anything. This is like a domestic pig.
Hmm.
And so the next day, my buddy and I were driving to work, and I'm telling him about this pig in the rain, because he lives in the area, and I'm like, have you ever seen some pig? You know? Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, that's weird. And like, I mean, I've lived here almost 50 years and never seen anything like that. And as I'm telling the story and we're going down the road, we pass by this farm, and right on the side of the road in front of this farm is a Great Pyrenees eating a black dog. And the black dog's laying there. I think it was a dog. It looked like a dog. And this Great Pyrenees, as we drive past, is like ripping up with its jaws, tearing the flesh from this thing. And I, again, weirdest thing, you know, you don't see that every day. You hear the saying dog eat dog, but right. You know, it certainly casts a new light on it.
yeah
so that was kind of strange, just nothing too out there. But
was it close to where you saw the pig walking?
No, it wasn't. Actually, it was about 15-20 minutes further down the road. Yeah, so
two separate incidents that just...
Two separate incidents within 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing, you know, something on the same stretch of road that is something that's very peculiar, things you don't see every day.
Yeah.
In these parts.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah. And of course, here the wilderness is just so vast. So vast. Just like so many places where that haven't even seen a human footprint. So, you know, but generally hunting and things like that, it's the same thing. You don't run into typically anything really bizarre like that. You know, everything is pretty status quo, if you will. Except for this one time I was hunting. And I wrote you about this. I'm at a place called Beaver Mouth. It's along the Quinault River. So I'm deer hunting. And this was probably about 25 years ago, 24 years ago. And I was by myself. Again, you can drive half an hour, 45 minutes. You're in the middle of nowhere with nobody around. It's just amazing. So amazing. And so I walk into this stand of trees. And there's a creek, you know, probably about 50 yards to my right. And I'm walking, starting to walk through. And I hear what sounds like at first, like rocks banging. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, the water's just moving. You know how sometimes you go near moving water, you can hear rocks moving in the water, right?
Yeah.
But it was fairly loud and pronounced. But I, you know, sort of brushed it off and kept walking in, looking for deer sign. And then it happened again, and it's just like, you know. And then I'm starting to think, are those rocks? Or is that, it almost sounds like wood, because it's starting to go. At first it was bang, bang. And now it was like this sound in the repetition of three. And, you know, again, I just kind of, it seems unusual, but, you know, I just kind of brush it off. And I'm just, in my mind, I'm thinking that it's something to do with the creek. And then I hear it again. But this time, I'm far enough away from the creek, and the sound's in a different direction of where the creek is. And it's a knocking sound. And I'm like, wait a second, that sounds like wood, like somebody's banging on a tree or something. So I grab, you know, I'm looking around, and I find a limb on the ground, and I whack this tree twice, you know, pretty good, like whack, whack. And then I hear it come back. The same sound.
So same pattern.
The same pattern, whack, whack. And over in the distance, further in the bush. And this was way before I started reading about Sasquatch and things like that. You know, I always kind of thought it was just a, you know, a fairy tale, right?
Right, yeah.
You know, there was never any really stories or anything like that around the area about Sasquatch, or nobody really talked about it. I mean, I'd seen clips of the Patterson-Gimlin film and things like that on TV, you know, but everybody's just always, oh, that's fake, that's fake, that's, you know, a guy in a suit. And, you know, so I didn't really hold much merit to it. And I mean, it didn't even enter my mind at the time. But what happened was, suddenly I felt disoriented. First, it was a feeling of dread, just like this feeling of like something is wrong. You know, yet, you know, trying to quantify what it was. It was just, I didn't know if it was somebody was out there, but I was armed, right? You know, and I'd been out in the bush since I was a kid. Lots of times by myself, you know, setting snares and trying to shoot grouse and things like that, and build forts. But this feeling was just like incredible. It was just like something I had never felt before. And I became disoriented, and it's almost like, you know, thinking back, trying to remember every detail, it's almost like small pieces of time were missing or something. But I had got out of there and made it back to my vehicle, and I just went home. I didn't continue hunting that day. I've never hunted back there again. And then a few years later, a buddy of mine gave me one of Rene de Hinden's books, and he just thought I would like it, you know, for something to read. And lo and behold, there's a segment in there about Sasquatch behavior, and one of them was about tree knocking.
Right.
And I got this really bad feeling in my stomach, and it was like, oh no. I'm like, okay. what what's going on, what, you know, and still to this day, I mean, I've never seen a Sasquatch. I've seen tracks like that First Nations friends locally have showed me on their cameras, and they record video of Sas, if they come across Sasquatch sign, mm-hmm. when they're out mushroom picking and things like that. They'll show me, hey, look at these tracks we found, you know, today. And if I meet up with them in town, and, you know, here's the big one, here's the small one. And but, you know, I've never actually myself laid eyes on a track or seen one.
Right. Well, that sequence of events you described, I don't know if you've ever heard me describe, I had a very similar sequence of events where I heard what I thought were stone on stone from behind me. And then I went up onto the top of this hill. This is a place I'd hiked. This is a park. It's not wilderness. It's, you know, it's wooded, but it's not wilderness. But, you know, I'd hiked it alone 1,000 times, had no reason to be afraid, you know, but, got up to the top of this hill, and then I heard what I felt was like wood on wood. Again, like you said, I'm not sure, but it sounded different. You know, the first one sounded like stone.
Yeah.
This sounded like wood on wood from the opposite direction. I got the smell at the same time.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, that just, and this is January, so, you know, it's not like the middle of summer where, you know, that kind of heavy stink from a dead animal just linger in the air. This is, right. It's nice and cold out, but this smell rolled in, and I got terrified. I mean, I wanted to run with all my being, and I couldn't because I was so scared my knees locked up. If I hadn't had my walking stick with me, I probably would have just sat down on the ground because I just couldn't move. I was that scared for no reason other than the smell and the sound. Like, there was nothing, you know, I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything else. And until, like, the whole episode ended, I heard what sounded like, it was very, very strange, sounded like very soft, not super loud, but very soft, like clicking gears almost. I can't explain that. But no, it was a very similar sequence of events. You know, I've hiked there before and since by myself and never had a problem. But that day, for whatever reason, I was so scared. I've never felt anything like that. And again, for no real good reason, you know, I just heard some sounds and got a bad smell, but it, whatever it was, just completely, completely frightened me.
You know, I've heard other people talk about the infrasound, and, you know, and I kind of wonder with their pheromones if they're able to replicate or induce the same type of feeling as, you know, like, I mean, we know that big cats have infrasound, right? And they sure. disorient their prey. You know, why not a higher order ape, right? And the popping, the clicking, it sounds like popping teeth. And I've heard bear do that before, mm-hmm. in the bush, hunting bear, when you're coming up on, you know. And my grandpa would always tell me about that. He says, when a bear's popping its teeth, it's ready to charge. It's ready to attack. Yeah. So he says, if you hear a bear popping your teeth, you better do something. You know, I used to have all of these, you know, as I learned about the subject, all these hard and fast theories. But now, the more I know or think I know or learn or hear about somebody else's stories or experiences, I realize I know very little about this phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's it's very difficult to pin down. And I always tell people, allow me to change opinions daily, because that's, I feel like, yeah, the only honest exactly. way to be anymore, where I just, like, one day let me think it's, you know, something supernatural, the next day I'm ready to hear evidence. I mean, because there's a lot of really good evidence that does make it sound like an animal or a relic hominid or something, you know, something absolutely. Somewhat natural.
You know? Yeah. You know, something that leaves hair, scat, and tracks.
Yep. Yep.
And if you believe, you know, that Dr. Melba Ketchum actually got her hands on a piece of DNA down in Texas there, you know, that study too, you know, there's some people that believe the study and the science behind it, and other people dispute it. But then you've got other things like the Patterson-Gimlin film, you know, that has been, you know, gone over. Yeah. So many times. And yeah.
And for me, that one comes down to, like, suit technology of the time. That's it, they just didn't have it. They didn't have the same technology at the time. So until
they still don't.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Yeah.
I've you know, unless you're using CGI, right? But you know, that's. You know, but for you know to do and the motions, the local motions, you know, and you guys got like Dr. Jeff Meldrum, who's you know really really good about you know the autonomy of the human and the locomotion of the creature. You know, it's just it's baffling.
Yeah, it very, very much is. Very much is. But incredibly interesting. I'm willing to follow it.
Yeah, and you get, you know, and then there's the other side of the fence, you know. Some people believe it's directly linked to UFO, right? And,
well,
you know, and you, there's a very strong correlation, I think, with that. But, you know, I kind of think, you know, I think, you know, sort of UFOs and life, other life in the galaxy, the universe is sort of passé now. We sort of basically all accept that it's a reality more so than anything now. I guess the questions remaining, have other life forms been here? Are they here still? And then, but we look at, you know, anecdotal stories of, you know, of the lights and Sasquatch sightings, right? Do I think it's causation? I don't know. But, you know, there's definitely some correlation. But, right. Yeah. You know, if you think if aliens have been coming and messing with humans for a millennia, why not Sasquatch, right?
Yeah. And we'll see, the my thing is, so I can look at, and I mean generally, like look at British Columbia and look at all the wilderness there and say, yeah, something could live out there that we would know about. Absolutely. But when you come to here, where I am, this is where I have a problem with a natural creature. And we might be talking about two different things. Like out here, maybe it's something that is mimicking a natural creature. Because out here, it's just very difficult. So I take tons of, well, not tons, but I take a lot of Bigfoot calls for the area locally. And we don't really have wilderness in this county. We have, you know, wooded areas, but, you know, as far as like places untouched, places where people haven't stepped, there's little to none here. And I just have a really hard time making a breeding population of giant ape men work in this area. But where you are, I don't have as big a problem at all. You know what I mean? For me, like, okay, it'll work there. But here, the impact they would leave on the environment, I would think would be very, very difficult for them to remain hidden in this area. So I wonder if there's not maybe multiple things going on in different places.
Yeah, and you hear different things like the migration pattern and, you know, and there's definitely the stories you hear people talking about, yeah, certain months of the year they're here and then other months of the year they're not. You know, and that kind of I think that kind of holds the same around here too. Like there's one community called Bella Coola. That's about a 7-hour drive from here on the coast, and it's in what's known as the Great Bear Rainforest.
Okay.
And Bella Coola is a really cool community. The people there are of Polynesian descent.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they've had the Polynesian islanders come and visit them because the Polynesians had tales of the people that had left by boat and went to this land, and the indigenous people there in Bella Coola have the stories of, yes, our people came across a long voyage across the open water, and their language is the only language in that region. And in British Columbia, it's pretty interesting. We have the highest concentration of various dialects of indigenous languages. There's 23, I believe, in the province, which is really, really interesting because, you know, as you go further out, you know, you basically have, you know, your main speaking groups. And again, Bella Coola, they have their own language that's not spoken anywhere else in the province. And they have a lot of Sasquatch. The Macs down there, First Nation guys, they're really into working on that problem down there. I say problem because I was down there a few years ago. My wife and I, we were there for a conference called Dancing in the Light. It was like it was a weekend conference on healing trauma and things like that. My wife's a counselor. It seemed almost immediately I ended up getting hooked up with a couple of the hereditary chiefs there. You know, I'm standing there listening to a conversation between, you know, I was standing there with these hereditary chiefs, and a couple other people came over, and they're like, oh, so how was it last night? They're like, terrible. All night again. The dog's going all night. We haven't slept for 2 weeks. Because they're basically, the community is basically a reserve, right? Mm-hmm. And a couple of reserves there. And I'm just like, oh, what's going on? Why aren't these people allowed to been able to sleep for 2 weeks? They said, oh, the Sasquatch are in. I'm like, oh. Wow. They said, yeah, there's an adult and a juvenile. And so they kept coming in at night, right on the tree line, right outside, because it's a pretty populated reserve, and screaming and, you know, getting the dogs barking and going back and forth along the tree line. But for them, it's just like, you know, it's just like an eagle or a bear or a deer. It's just something that they've lived with for, you know, hundreds, probably thousands of years that they've been there.
Right.
So to them, it's just like, yeah, that's what it is. You know, there's no big mystery. There's, you know, it's just for them, it's just an animal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And in the area, too, there seems to be a couple of divergent species. So there's like the Bakwas, which is like what they refer to as the Mudmen. These are like a leaner Sasquatch and apparently quite vicious. The other ones are more like the, like your type one, I guess, like your paddy type.
Paddy type, yeah, yeah.
And so when they're deeper in the rainforest picking mushrooms and things like that, that's typically the type that they see. But these other ones are, you know, fairly mischievous and aggressive, and they've had, you know, it just, their stories are just amazing. You know, some of them are pretty funny, some of them are scary.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've had all these generations and thousands of years, you know, living beside the phenomena, whatever it is. You know, natural or otherwise, they've lived beside it, and they've just collected these stories and just added it to their tradition. It's amazing.
Yeah, and in a very old story locally here, a First Nations reserve called Nasco, about an hour away from the city I live in. When I was in college in First Nations studies, they were talking about the origin of their people, and the origin of their people was that they came to this area, to the Nasco area, where there's the river and a volcano. So they liked this place and tried to settle down, but some creature was coming down from the mountains, and from this mountain, this cave, and you know, people were going missing and things like that. And then finally they decided to send their warriors up there, and what was up there is described as a cannibalistic giant, covered in hair and gruesome and all of these other things. And I remember my professor asking the class, so what do you guys think about that? She's Shepwemic, which is a people little south of us. And I was just like, that sounds like a Sasquatch to me. She goes, well, could be, you know, like, but that's part of their origin story, that they, you know, in order for them to live and remain where they have for, you know, however long they were there, they had to kill this creature up in the cave at the volcano.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's just like, I sometimes with the Bigfoot shows and things like that, you know, and in many ways, we're transcending that tradition. Like, it's anecdotal evidence. It's passing on the stories, right? This is what I've seen. This is where I saw it. You know, don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's very much the same amongst the First Nations people, right? They, you know, they pass down, it's knowledge. Yes. And they're passing it down for a reason. Like, don't eat that berry. Don't exactly. touch that plant. Exactly. Don't crawl into a den with a bear. And if this creature comes howling, you stay away from it, right?
Yeah. Don't leave your kids at the edge of the wood line. You know. And I think that's very important to point out because, in general, I consider myself a folklorist, not a scientist, as regards to recording these stories and so forth. But I don't consider that a dirty word because folklore is different from fiction in exactly the way you pointed out. Because yeah. a lot of times these stories were, like you said, this berry will heal you, this one will kill you. You know, this root is good for headaches, this root is, you know, good for whatever, blank. And this is the kind of knowledge that was passed down. Well, the knowledge of these creatures, of these various paranormal creatures or you know, folkloric creatures, whatever you want to call them, was passed down right the same way. And I believe there's a reason for that.
Absolutely.
They were teaching us how to deal with them.
Yeah, it wasn't for entertainment value. Mm-hmm. It was for survival. And some of my First Nations friends that I talk to, you know, their people say, those things were here before we got here. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, you know, depending on, you know, the location and things like that, you know, and you know, it's probably safe to say that First Nations people have been here for, you know, 20,000 years. Right. You know, they've found more and more artifacts and arrowheads and things like that. So that's a long time.
Yeah.
So if those creatures were here before then, you know, it's of course they're going to come across them, and you know, and it just all the stories, especially in BC, you know, you hear them of even Bigfoot talking Salish, mm-hmm. And being able to mimic language and different things like that, and. You know, and then back again to the mystical part, you know, like my friend, he's Nootka and he's from Vancouver Island. And he says his people believe that they're a dimensional being, interdimensional being that come into this world to give birth to their young. That's what his people believe.
Well,
you know, and I think it's did they see something that would lead them to believe that or is it just. Because the Sasquatch are such adapt creatures of nature that when you go to try to track them and stalk them or find them, you know, they're gone. Like, they vanished into thin air.
And, yeah, I tend to, lately, you know, as I get more, as I age and get more woo with this stuff, I tend to take those stories in stride and not so much in doubt, but with the idea that earlier people, or, you know, earlier generations of people knew a bear when they saw a bear, just as well as we know a bear when we see a bear, and they knew something natural when they saw something natural, just as well as we do, and they probably have a reason for saying it's supernatural. You know, they yeah. probably saw something, some sort of evidence that convinced them that, okay, this is not like us. This is something different. But again, you know, it's a hard thing to talk about, especially for people who desire to prove this in a very scientific way. It's very frustrating
for
them.
It's pretty hard to quantify, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and just like, you know, our experiences of being disoriented and mm-hmm. things like that. How do you quantify that? Like, how do you, you know, can you replicate that in a laboratory?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Unless you got infrasound or maybe some scent pheromones that may cause a similar reaction. Mm-hmm. It's you know, and if that happened to people thousands of years ago here, and you know, the infrasound and the smell and things like that knocked them into next week. I could see that they would definitely see, you know, that as a causation, right? That it,
sure.
it's something. Complete that it is something actually unnatural, but it is in existence.
Right. If they have these various evolutionary advantages, they might as well be paranormal. Is the way I look at it at this point. They have abilities beyond what we can understand that other natural animals have, a collection of abilities. So it's not just infrasound. It's infrasound. It's the ability to understand camouflage in ways that we have no clue of. You know, it's super fast movement, super strength, you know, the ability to realize that they could be being tracked and so forth. So it's this collection of evolutionary skills that make them a super animal, really, or a super being, if they're some form of human.
Oh, for sure. Which, you know, they've been crafting this for a millennia,
mm-hmm.
or for whenever they had evolved, if they evolved from something, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And it reminds me of the quote they said, what is it? And I'll get it wrong, but it's basically any technology, you know, can look like magic to someone who doesn't understand the technology, basically. It's very similar, I think, in this. Is if they have this collection of natural abilities, this evolutionary advantage that's so far beyond what other animals have, then it's almost paranormal in as much as, you know, for one animal or one creature, one being, to have all of these evolutionary advantages, it's pretty incredible.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes it's in breeding too. Like, we've got tracking dogs and, you know, things like that. We, you know, kind of know, oh, they got all these scent receptors, but it is dang amazing what a good tracking dog can do.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You know what? That in itself is like a superpower.
Oh, sure.
Or something of otherworldly, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, well, if you don't understand how it works, it absolutely does seem like a superpower. You know, it's just like, wow.
These other creatures that we know exist and have these, you know, these different adaptations to thrive in their habitat and environment. And we just kind of, that's just them. We accept that. But, you know, I don't want to get going down that street.
Yeah, no, we could talk for
hours. I could go on for hours.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Al, thank you so much for sharing your stories.
Thank you. I really enjoy your show. You know, it's been a pleasure. It's just, I like the way you branch out into the paranormal and you listen to people, and it's just great. Please keep up the good work.
Well, thank you so much.
Adopting a dog can be one of the best decisions in your life. But sometimes trying to raise a dog can be frustrating, it can be overwhelming, and you need help. 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you develop the perfect relationship with your puppy. It is a relationship-based approach to helping you and your puppy become perfect for each other. There are online sources, they have video lessons, they have a secret Facebook group where you can get together with other puppy owners who may be having similar issues to you.
Maybe you can combine shoes, like if one chewed a left one and one chewed the right, you could make one pair of shoes.
One pair of shoes amongst you. There's also one-on-one options available. Find 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy at sidhappens.us. Go ahead and look for the 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy link at the top of the page. 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you understand how your dog thinks and apply proactive training methods to help you and your puppy become perfect for each other. 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy, again, find them at sidhappens.us. So after the two Through the Haunted Forest episodes, we dropped Return to Pandemonium for patrons last week. So it was kind of a on-site week as well as a sort of a adjunct part of the June Bigfoot episodes. Every month we do at least one full episode of Strange Familiars for our patrons. If you like what we do, if you want to hear more Strange Familiars and help us create the show, you can become a patron at Patreon. It's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. $3 a month gets you those extra episodes and other content, but there are all different levels there. You can check it out. Go to patreon.com/strangefamiliars. And of course, we want to thank our patrons for helping us make Strange Familiars. We could not make the show without you, so thank you very much, patrons. If you want to help and you don't like the idea of a monthly subscription like Patreon, you can go to strangefamiliars.com. Look in the show notes under every episode. You'll find a paypal.me link where you can make a one-time donation. Everyone can help by sharing the show on social media, by liking and subscribing wherever you're listening, and by leaving us those nice 5-star reviews, which helps get the show in front of new potential listeners. I want to thank Jason W. and Jessica R. for their donations. Thank you so much, guys. I think both of them are repeat donators as well. So thank you so much. That's a big help. And we're on to photo of the week of some youths who have obviously been fishing.
I thought I would go with like a summertime theme today.
Or at least stealing other people's fish.
Yeah.
We don't in fact know that they were fishing. We only know that they have a stringer of fish. But we'll assume they were fishing. No, it's a really neat photo. It's really neatly composed, I think.
Sort of dandy ruffians.
Young, no good nicks. They look suspiciously timeless in their clothing.
They do, yeah, yeah. They don't look specifically of that era.
Which is, you're guessing...
I'm guessing like, what do you say, tens? Tens to teens,
maybe? Early 1900s, yeah. Sometime.
It's gelatin silver. If you look at it in the light, you can see the silver coming up.
Mounted photograph. It's really cool. Again, if you're interested in starting a new hobby of collecting photographs and helping the show, you can find these in our Etsy shop, or you can go to the show notes under this episode. See an image of this photo. You can click on it. It'll take you to our Etsy shop where you can purchase this for $15. You can also purchase the artwork for this week's episode. My artwork for this episode, and I have other originals up there, although they're selling fairly well, so I have to add some more originals.
Yeah, this week's is nice. It's like kind of a takeoff of the logo in a way.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of do a play on the Awoken Tree logo. So you can purchase that there as well. I'll put that in the show notes too if you want to click on that. It'll take you to our Etsy shop. And of course, there's other photos of the week there. There are signed copies of Where the Footprints End. Unfortunately, not signed by me and Josh because we're in different states, but signed by me. And lots of other Strange Familiar stuff there as well.
I will be able to sign on behalf of Josh with his signature. I've been practicing.
Somebody had a great idea. They said, why didn't you make a book plate with your artwork and that you could both sign?
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, well, a little late for that, but maybe we'll do that.
In the alternate timeline, that's how it worked.
Well, we'll do it, you know, in time for Volume 2, perhaps. I'll do my best. There's a lot of work I have to put into Volume 2, so I might not have time to design a book plate.
Oh, it's in your head now. You'll do it.
We'll see. I'll do my best. But that's all in our Etsy shop. Shop name, Lost Grave, one word if you're on Etsy, or you can find links in the show notes at strangefamiliars.com. We will be back soon with more Strange Familiars. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts, music, books, art, podcasts, and more. DarkHollerArts.com. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. Go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com for more. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars, where you can join the Strange Familiars Gathering Group, and we are on Instagram at Strange Familiars.
Night breeze. but did not shed. His hair so red. He tried to run. You raised your gun. The man is dead. Run free in the night breeze. The red dog flies. Oh, leave him be. Let him run free in the night breeze.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.